Advantage Products presents The Money Managers as part of a series of presentations on secrets of the great investors, narrated by Louis Rukeyser.
In the world of finance and investment, few terms conjure up as many conflicting images as that of professional money manager. On one hand, money managers who achieve extraordinary investment returns for their clients are celebrated in a way that may elevate them to near mythic status. On the other hand, many people have a persistent and uneasy distrust of money managers. They have concerns about money managers' motivations, the role of self-interest, and the prospects for consistent future performance. This conflicting image is a central theme in what may be Wall Street's oldest and most frequently told joke.
Once, in the dear dead days beyond recall, an out-of-town visitor was being shown the wonders of New York's financial district. When the party arrived at the tip of Manhattan on the shores of the New York Harbor, one of his guides pointed to some handsome ships riding at anchor. He said, "Look, over there are the banker's yachts, and over there are the broker's yachts, and over there are the money manager's yachts." Then the naive visitor, looking about, asked, "But where are the customer's yachts?"
This question, or some question similar to it, resonates throughout financial history. Long before the words Wall Street were ever heard, money managers were helping to oversee the financial affairs of pharaohs, kings, emperors, popes, merchant traders, and anyone else who needed help finding a productive return on his or her capital. Sometimes those managers could point with pride to the yachts of their customers. At other times, less fortunate or less skillful managers have been handed their heads on a plate. The role and responsibilities of today's professional money managers were defined early in the 19th century. The definition of a modern money manager grew out of a court case involving the way money managers had handled an estate that had been placed in trust. When John McLean of Boston had died in 1823, he left an estate of $50,000. The money was to be held in trust for his wife, who would live off its income during her lifetime. After her death, the remaining funds were to be divided in half between Harvard College and the Massachusetts General Hospital. Just 5 years after Mr. McLean died, his wife died also, and the estate was valued at only $29,450, a 41% loss of principal. The trustees had selected dividend-paying stocks that paid Mrs. McLean more than highly conservative bonds would have paid. But the market value of the stocks had dropped. In the early 19th century, investors more commonly selected high-quality government and corporate bonds, so the trustees' choice of stocks was highly unusual. Angered by their loss of a potentially large gift, Harvard and Massachusetts General sued the trustees of the estate, claiming incompetent management and demanding that the trustees make good on the difference. In 1830, a decision was delivered by Judge Samuel Putnam, one of the 19th century's greatest jurists, who ruled in favor of the trustees' actions.
"All that can be required of a trustee to invest is that he shall conduct himself faithfully and exercise a sound discretion. He is to observe how men of prudence, discretion, and intelligence manage their own affairs, not in regard to speculation, but in regard to the permanent disposition of their funds, considering the probable income as well as the probable safety of the capital to be invested. Trustees should not be held to make good on losses in the depreciation of stocks, or the failure of the capital itself, which they held in trust, provided they conduct themselves honestly and discreetly and carefully, according to the existing circumstances in the discharge of their trusts. If this were held otherwise, no prudent man would run the hazard of losses which might happen without any neglect or breach of good faith.
This landmark decision quickly became commonly referred to as the prudent man rule. It has been the cornerstone of the legal relationship between professional money managers and their clients. And it also has shaped the unofficial and implied dynamics of this often complex relationship. The prudent man rule has been interpreted in many ways since 1830, with implications that remain to this day. While providing money managers leeway in investment judgment, Putnam's decision also helped establish the criteria for a manager's responsibilities to clients. Putnam's declaration that managers must conduct themselves honestly and discreetly and carefully has in itself prompted many lawsuits through the years. The fact that the prudent man rule was furnished by a Boston judge has geographic significance in the historical development of money management. By the early 1800s, the Boston financial scene already was an established center for professional portfolio managers. Just as New York was developing into America's primary center for stock trading and investment banking, the so-called Boston trustee also was evolving into an important business tradition. In the early 20th century, this led to the creation of the mutual fund concept, an idea first put to practical use in Boston. In fact, one of Judge Samuel Putnam's descendants, George Putnam, became a pioneer in the mutual fund field by establishing Boston-based Putnam Investments in the 1920s. Financial journalist Diana Henriquez traces the early development of the Boston trustee.
When the 19th century opened, Boston's commercial giants were the men who had made their fortunes by opening the trade routes to the east, or by harnessing the power of the regional waterways to build mighty textile plants. By mid-century, the laurels went to the daring financiers who built vast railroad networks or mining operations out of scraps of paper that changed hands on the nation's fledgling stock exchanges. But as the century rolled toward its closing days, Boston had become less a producer of new money than a guardian of old money. The paladin of financial Boston was the private trustee, the man who tended the legendary captain's treasure chest and the dead financier's portfolios year in and year out for an annual fee.
One 19th century beneficiary of the Boston trustee and of the latitude offered by the prudent man definition was the estate of a great 18th century money pundit, Ben Franklin. Franklin had earmarked some of his estate for charity and directed that the funds be split, half to be managed by a trustee in Boston and half by a trustee in Philadelphia. 100 years after his death in 1791, the money left to the Philadelphia trustee was less than one-third the amount accumulated under the stewardship of the Boston trustee. The Philadelphia endowment had been managed under the most conservative procedures, with preserving capital as the sole goal. The Boston trustee, using the more liberal concept of the prudent man rule, was a real-world proof of the value of giving investment freedom to a trustee. Even people investing for the shorter term came to recognize the potential of the Boston trustee approach. And this became the model that has shaped the basic concept of money management in the United States. But just as Boston has been the birthplace of innovations in professional money management and the scene of some of the profession's proudest moments, Boston also has been the birthplace of some of the greatest scandals in the money management industry. Perhaps most significant among Boston's infamous money managers was Charles Ponzi, who in 1920 embarked on a money management swindle that robbed millions of dollars from thousands of trusting people. The phrase Ponzi scheme has been famous ever since. Financial historian Matthew Josephson recaps the Ponzi story in the book The Money Lords.
An ex-convict named Charles Ponzi, who had formerly been a peddler and a waiter, one day decided to become a wizard of finance. He had a plan that seemed simple and foolproof. Armed with $150 in cash, he advertised his willingness to borrow money from the public at 50% interest for 45 days and 100% for 90 days. By taking advantage of differences in official and actual rates of exchange, he planned to use the money to buy international postal coupons in one country where the rate was low and sell them in another for a higher price. It was not a bad idea, but it became complicated in operation and could not work on a large scale. Ponzi paid interest promptly on the money he received, but soon was reduced to paying it with fresh capital that came in floods. The more investors he attracted, the deeper he went into debt. After he had taken in nearly $10 million and issued notes for more than $14 million in 8 months, his operation was exposed as a fraud, shut down by authorities of Massachusetts, and Ponzi was soon in jail.
Ponzi's methods probably did not originate with him, and they most certainly did not end with his arrest and conviction. Pyramid schemes remain perennially effective in virtually every corner of the world, often luring and fooling otherwise sophisticated investors. One spectacular example from the late 20th century featured a seemingly altruistic investment pool for charities called the Foundation for New Era Philanthropy. Headed by a former drug counselor named John Bennett, the pool followed the classic Ponzi style from 1989 until the scheme was revealed in 1995. In the spring of 1997, when Bennett finally stopped trying to evade prosecution, the New York Times summarized the details of the fraud.
After trying to blame phantom voices that he said gave him bad financial advice, the man accused of cheating universities and charities of more than $100 million pleaded no contest today to federal charges of fraud and money laundering. For 6 years, beginning in 1989, John G. Bennett was a prominent figure in the arts world, celebrated for his promise to double the investment of any nonprofit group within 6 months. The unusually high dividends, he said, came from wealthy philanthropists who wanted to make anonymous donations to charity. Hundreds of universities and art institutions signed on, including the Philadelphia Orchestra, the American Red Cross, and the Salvation Army. And institutions like Harvard, Princeton, and Brown universities. But what Bennett had done, prosecutors assert, was to pay off earlier investors with money from new ones, while skimming off a substantial portion for himself.
The New Era fund scandal was not isolated. In the mid-1990s, the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, Arthur Levitt, warned of the increasing rise of Ponzi-style schemes. He noted that it's difficult to uncover the fraudulent schemes until it's too late to recover money for victims. By contrast, other money managers in the Boston trustee tradition have been role models for the best that the field has to offer. One dominant figure was Paul Cabot, often referred to as the father of modern investment management. Cabot was newly graduated from Harvard University in 1920 when Charles Ponzi was operating his scheme at full force. But Cabot followed another path, and by 1924 had started State Street Investment Company, one of the first mutual funds in America. State Street is Boston's equivalent to New York's Wall Street, and Cabot's firm helped establish his reputation as a titan of money management. Cabot is most famous for the skill he showed later in life, when he managed the endowment of Harvard University from 1948 until 1965. His prudent man approach, applied to a staid institution like Harvard, was considered innovative. Some critics considered him reckless. In the early 1950s, Cabot insisted on dramatically increasing Harvard's holdings of common stocks, and this allowed the university to participate in the post-World War II bull market of the 1950s and early 1960s. It took several years before Cabot's approach proved worthy of notice, but as Business Week magazine noted in 1959, there were changing ideas about what was appropriate for university endowment funds.
Boston is preeminently an investment center, and its State Street community claims more experienced investment men per capita than any other city in the country. Moreover, Boston is confident that in the exacting job of investing funds for either income or appreciation, it bows to no one. Faith in equities is not universally regarded as a conservative investment policy, but to proper Bostonians, any other course would entail even greater risks. Paul Cabot, for one, has brought about a major shift in Harvard's portfolio since taking over as treasurer in 1948. Then, only 30% of the total was in common stocks, the remainder in debt obligations of one sort or another. In the fiscal year ended last June, Harvard had almost 60% in commons.
Under Cabot's leadership, the Harvard endowment grew from $200 million to over $1 billion. In the process, Cabot revolutionized investing for nonprofit organizations. In addition to Charles Ponzi and Paul Cabot, a third Bostonian helped define traditions in another important mechanism of modern financial management, independent financial journalism. Clarence Walker Barron became owner of the New York-based Wall Street Journal in 1901. His name became immortalized on the masthead of Barron's Financial Weekly when that publication was launched in 1921. But Barron's ideals actually began to be seen when, at age 21 in 1876, he persuaded editors at the Boston Evening Transcript to allow him to start the newspaper's first financial page. 21 years later, in 1887, Barron established a business news syndicate based in Boston. Soon, his fame, influence, and increasing fortunes allowed him to take over the New York-based Dow Jones publications. Throughout his long career, Clarence Barron ardently and enthusiastically promoted the best in money management by printing detailed stories of investment successes. At the same time, he routed out the financial world's crooks with tireless investigative reporting. In fact, one of Barron's most famous exposés involved Charles Ponzi. In 1920, Barron editorialized about his investigation into the Ponzi operation.
No man of wide financial or investment experience would look twice at a proposition to take his money upon a simple promise to pay it back with 50% increase in 45 days, which means a 200% annual rate. According to the facts thus far gathered, the whole transaction looks to me like an immoral one. Right under the eyes of government court officials, Mr. Ponzi has been paying out U.S. money to one line of depositors from deposits made by a succeeding line. It is time for responsible officials to act in the Ponzi matter. Our government and our laws to protect the poor are being brought into contempt.
Ponzi tried to sue Barron for these remarks, but the suit was dropped after Ponzi was arrested. Barron continued to be an enthusiastic champion and sharp-eyed critic of the financial world until he died in 1928. His work set a standard for financial journalism by providing an invaluable service. He was a watchdog for his readers. Clarence Barron uncovered many of the bad deals, unscrupulous people, and unsound practices that threatened the legitimate pursuit of owning a yacht. Money managers come in all sorts of varieties. Some manage the money of institutions, such as banks and insurance companies. Some are caretakers of public and private pension funds. Others directly control or influence the investment activities of individuals. Speaking precisely, the prudent man rule of 1830 related only to the freedoms and responsibilities of a manager with wholly discretionary power over funds held in a client's legal trust. The decision was not intended to provide such freedoms to managers of testamentary trusts, who are custodians for a client's investment holdings, with an added possibility of providing investment advice. that the prudent man guidelines also are essentially limited to money managers whose client retains all the risk of the manager's actions. Such a manager is called a pass-through intermediary, since risk passes through the manager to the client. This fundamentally differs from a financial institution that is the risk-taking intermediary. For example, a bank that guarantees an interest rate return to a depositor is a risk-taking intermediary. The depositor earns that interest amount whether or not the bank's money manager wisely invests the deposited funds. By contrast, the bank's trust department oversees portfolios owned by individual customers, and here functions as a pass-through intermediary. Portfolio management by a trust department once was the province of only the wealthiest individuals. However, during the last half of the 20th century, this type of service has developed and expanded into a financial services industry that reaches people with modest investment assets. The number of pass-through intermediaries has grown explosively. Yet the mystique of the money management field lies with the reputation of a few legendary money managers. Foremost among those legends is Warren Buffett, whose stellar performance is described by Wall Street Journal columnist Roger Lowenstein in the biography entitled Buffett, The Making of an American Capitalist.
In the annals of investing, Warren Buffett stands alone. Starting from scratch, simply by picking stocks and companies for investment, Buffett amassed one of the epical fortunes of the 20th century. Over a period of four decades, more than enough to iron out the effects of fortuitous rolls of the dice, Buffett outperformed the stock market by a stunning margin and without taking undue risks or suffering a single losing year. This is a feat that market savants, Main Street brokers, and academic scholars had long proclaimed to be impossible. By virtue of this steady, superior compounding, Buffett acquired a magical seeming net worth of $15 billion and counting. Buffett did this in markets bullish and bearish and through economies fat and lean. Over the broad sweep of post-war America, as the major stock averages advanced by 11% or so a year, Buffett racked up a compounded annual gain of 29.2%.
Undoubtedly, Buffett's investment performance has been outstanding. It represents the pinnacle of money management success. But strictly speaking, Buffett did not achieve those results as a money manager handling portfolios for individual clients. Nor did he have a trustee's type of prudent man responsibility for the money he managed. Instead, Buffett's investments were part of the business operations of Berkshire Hathaway, which Buffett has controlled since 1965. During an earlier part of his investing career, Buffett did directly manage money for individuals as part of a limited partnership that he headed. But in 1969, during a period that looked to many like history's biggest and completely unstoppable bull market, Buffett decided to stop managing money in the partnership format. This decision was prompted in part by Buffett's uneasiness with excesses that he saw, and by the pressures on him to meet the high, perhaps unrealistic, expectations of the individuals whose money he was handling. Buffett commented at the time,
"I am not attuned to this market environment, and I don't want to spoil a decent record by trying to play a game I don't understand, just so I can go out a hero. If I'm going to participate publicly, I can't help being competitive. I know I don't want to be totally occupied with outpacing an investment rabbit all my life."
Buffett's observation turned out to be correct. Soon after his partnership was dissolved, the stock and bond markets in 1970 went into a tailspin that began more than a decade of highly turbulent market activity. Buffett's later investment activities at Berkshire Hathaway gave him the freedom that few managers of individual portfolios could enjoy under the concept of the prudent man rule. Similarly, managers of mutual funds, some with a legendary status rivaling that of Warren Buffett, are not bound by the responsibilities and obligations of a personal money manager. A mutual fund manager is required only to pursue the investment criteria as defined in the public disclosure prospectus, which details the fund's investment goals and techniques. From a legal point of view, an investor's decision to place money in a mutual fund is based on the fund's investment objectives, not on the expectation that the fund manager will provide comprehensive portfolio management geared to one person's unique financial needs. As the number of investment advisors providing comprehensive portfolio management has continued to explode, it has come to be a challenge to sort them out and to define precisely who is and who is not a money manager. David Case, a former stockbroker, offers one important distinction.
A money manager should not be confused with a financial planner. A financial planner addresses a client's entire financial situation and offers advice on such diverse topics as insurance policies, taxes, investments, college expenses, etc., and then works within a plan to achieve certain financial goals. The money manager, on the other hand, has a much narrower role. He manages a client's money by creating a portfolio of investments from a variety of products commonly found on Wall Street, such as stocks, bonds, and T-bills. He then oversees that portfolio, buying and selling, when he sees fit. The major difference between working with a money manager and a broker is that you are literally placing your money in a money manager's hands and telling him to use his own judgment. As a norm, managers don't have to consult with you on buying or selling your portfolio because you have given them the power of discretionary trading. That is a prime example of how much power a money manager has.
As the exact roles and responsibilities continue to overlap and blur for different types of investment consultants, the distinction between a money manager and a financial planner often comes down to the way each is compensated. The nature of compensation reflects in turn possible conflicts of interest. Typically, a money manager charges an annual fee, ranging possibly from 0.5% to 2% or more of the assets under management. A money manager who is a broker-dealer also may charge additional brokerage commissions. On the other hand, financial planners usually are compensated either from commissions on products they recommend, such as insurance policies, annuities, or mutual funds, or from a set fee, usually charged to the client on an hourly basis. Some financial planners combine the features of commissions and fees in a plan called fee offset. Here, fees are offset by commissions earned if a client buys a financial product recommended by the planner. Because a purely commission-based financial planner may have a conflict of interest, more and more financial planners are providing investment advice on a fee-only basis. The potential conflict of interest also raises the question of the role of broker as money manager or investment advisor. Financial writer John Train, himself an investment advisor, takes umbrage at the notion that brokers can also be independent sources of valid investment recommendation.
I deplore the tricky use of the word consultant by some brokerage firms. Brokers have a commercial, not a professional relationship with the customer, do not have to be disinterested, are not required to know your entire circumstances, and live by selling you things you may or may not need. It's as though a drugstore called itself a clinic.
But others judge this potential for conflict in a far more benign way. In the classic book of investment advice entitled How to Buy Stocks, a perennial bestseller since the first edition was published in 1953, author Louis Engel notes that brokers have a great interest in satisfying their customers.
Yes, a broker is a salesman, but that doesn't mean that your interests and his are completely opposed. Quite the contrary. Any salesman of any product wants his customer to be satisfied, because that's the best way of building his own business. That's especially true of the broker.
Engel's view was perhaps somewhat colored by the fact that he was advertising director for a brokerage, Merrill Lynch, when he wrote his highly influential book. In fact, the book grew out of a Merrill Lynch advertising campaign intended to encourage wider involvement in the stock market after World War II. In the 1990s, brokerages created a concept called the WRAP account, that's W-R-A-P, as a way to help brokers be perceived more like disinterested money managers. The nature of a WRAP account is explained in the Barron's Guide to Making Investment Decisions.
In a WRAP account, a broker will match you with one or more professional money managers who will more or less tailor a portfolio for you, overseen by your broker. The attraction is that you get professional management without having to ante up the hefty minimums that most money managers require, and all for a single annual fee. But what a fee! Typically, a WRAP account will cost 3% of assets, more than what you would have to pay to get a good money manager.
Government regulations also try to define the differences among the people who provide investment-related services. Money managers who handle money for or sell fee-based investment advice to more than 15 people must register with the Securities and Exchange Commission as investment advisors, whether or not they happen to be brokers. This requirement was established by the Federal Investment Advisors Act of 1940, which officially defined an investment advisor as
any person who, for compensation, engages in the business of advising others, either directly or through publications or writings, as to the value of securities, or as to the advisability of investing in, purchasing, or selling securities, or who, for compensation and as part of a regular business, issues or promulgates analyses or reports concerning securities.
As with federal legislation on other matters in the securities industry, investment advisors are deterred from wrongdoing or unethical behavior by the principles of public disclosure and self-regulation by securities industry groups. Investment advisors who register with the SEC are not required to have any particular educational or professional achievements. Legislators apparently believe that no amount of education or professional experience can prove the competence or incompetence of anyone who claims the ability to manage money or give investment advice. Only a nominal fee is required to be officially recognized by the government as a registered investment advisor. However, all registered advisors must disclose any possible conflicts of interest, plus details about their personal background. The registration is a public document, available to anyone for review. Another potential deterrent to unscrupulous behavior is the SEC's broad and largely undefined ability to investigate and prosecute registered advisors who abuse or defraud clients. Many states have regulatory requirements that go beyond those of the federal government. Despite this seemingly complex litany of official registration requirements, the criteria are actually quite broad for defining who may present themselves as knowledgeable advisors and for measuring the effectiveness of professional money managers. Superior investment results by managers like Warren Buffett tend to demonstrate that professional money managers can add substantial value. But as we'll see, the real-world cost-effectiveness of money managers as a whole has been continually and seriously questioned since the early 1970s. A watershed year in professional money management occurred in 1974, when two dramatic events changed assumptions about money managers and their role. First was the passage of a law designed to protect pension holders from recklessness or misuse of funds by pension fund managers. The so-called Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, known commonly as ERISA, included a bombshell that essentially embellished the original Prudent Man rule. For the first time, federal law addressed the concept of the prudent man by stating that money managers must fulfill their responsibilities
with the care, skill, prudence, and diligence under the circumstances then prevailing that a prudent man acting in a like capacity and familiar with such matters would use in the conduct of an enterprise of a like character and with like aims.
This wording demands that a prudent man must be familiar with such matters, thus effectively requiring that money managers must act with some level of expertise. This goes far beyond the original prudent man rule, which said that a prudent man conducts himself honestly and discreetly and carefully. With ERISA, a manager after 1974 was held to the standards of other managers in what the law called an enterprise of a like character and with like aims. This law was written to apply specifically to pension fund managers. However, it came to be viewed as a law extending to all people who advise investors or have responsibility for the investments of another person. The law also stated that pension funds must be diversified in order to minimize risk. This, too, was a revolutionary redefinition of a money manager's legal responsibility. Previously, individual investments were evaluated to judge whether the manager was prudent. If each piece of a portfolio was deemed sound, then the overall portfolio was considered sound and prudent, no matter how many pieces were included in the portfolio. Risk now was to be evaluated by considering the entire portfolio, so that diversification now became legally necessary to control a client's risk exposure. Over time, investors have come to recognize the basic concept of portfolio diversification. The term asset allocation also has come to be an accepted term for dividing a portfolio into different types of investments. But in 1974, this was a radical concept, and it was not widely understood or followed. The other major event of 1974 was extreme distress in financial markets. Few money managers had ever experienced anything like it. Peter Bernstein, financial writer and founding editor of the Journal of Portfolio Management, recalls,
October 1974 saw the culmination of the worst bear market in common stocks since the great crash of 1929. By the time prices finally touched bottom, market values had fallen more than 40% from what they had been 2 years earlier. That was not all. In just a year and a half, the cost of living jumped 20%, more than 1% a month. After adjustment for inflation, the entire rise in stock prices since 1954 had been erased. At the same time, the bond market, the traditional haven for the risk-averse, suffered a 35% loss of purchasing power.
This sharp reversal from more than 25 post-war years of financial progress startled professional money managers, and it startled the clients, who had enjoyed a nearly unbroken record of success.
No one emerged unscathed. Distress brought pressure for change throughout the world of finance. The way professionals manage their clients' capital, the structure of the financial system itself, the functioning of the markets, the range of investment choices available to savers, and the role of finance in the profitability and competitiveness of American companies. Many of the star portfolio managers of the go-go years of the 1960s disappeared in the rubble.
Some money managers responded to these changes by looking for some type of personal protection from potentially angered clients. The Wall Street Journal reported in late 1974,
pension managers are scrambling for insurance, protecting them from suits. The new pension reform law throws a scare into corporate officials responsible for managing the assets of pension funds. Under the law, they can be held personally liable for a fund's losses. Many seek insurance. Says M.R. Ratner, president of Professional Indemnity Agency Incorporated, it's just unbelievable. Literally tens of thousands of executives are looking for insurance coverage on this.
Amid this trauma, managers and trustees turned to abstract concepts developed by academicians. Peter Bernstein observes,
had it not been for the crisis of 1974, few financial practitioners would have paid attention to the ideas that had been stirring in the ivory towers for some 20 years. But when it turned out that improvised strategies to beat the market served only to jeopardize their clients' interests, practitioners realized that they had to change their ways.
This is the end of Side 1. Please fast forward and turn over your cassette.